Okay, so, but I'm going to make it, the talk will have sort of two parts, because it was advertised as a general interest, so I'm going to talk for the first half of the session more broadly about principles of communicating to the public and to the press. And for the second half, I wanted to focus more specifically on a question for the climate change people that I challenged you with earlier in the week. That is, when you're faced with the public, either in a formal setting or at a cocktail party, and they say, well, what is this level, is this climate change really happening? What are the three most convincing arguments you find, you think might work best to convince them? So I must preface this. The comments that I'm going to have specifically refer to talking to a public group as opposed to a scientific group, because I think the content is somewhat different. And I will say that I've been very pleased in recent years that I think the PowerPoint, PowerPoint has greatly improved the talks.
At the very least, people are used to handwrite overhead transparencies. At least now you can read their writing. Okay, so the first basic principle, I think, is very important, is that decide on your key points, and I put very few key points, because you really don't want to inundate someone with a lot of detail. They won't remember it. Just decide which things you really want to get across. And so a lot of the work of a good talk has to be done way up front, even if you're going to be talking to the press. Decide which things, which of all the things that you have, you want to see maybe appear in the newspaper article. Obviously, it's not going to be everything. So sometimes this involves a lot of trade-offs. And the key one, I think, is in talking with the press, is sound bites versus caveats. The scientists want to make all these caveats because nothing's exactly black and white. You say, well, this is true under these and these and these circumstances. And the reporter doesn't want to put all those details in. That's pretty dull, and it takes a lot of space. He wants his sound bite. So if you can think of a soundbite ahead of time, help out the reporter. I mean, it's going to increase the chances that you'll get into the paper. Figure out some compromise which you think is true enough and yet of interest to the public. You know, I don't mean say it wrong or exaggerated, but it's just that trade-off you have to think a lot about.
Is your impression that when scientists caveat, that's a very one. Do they overdo it? Do you think they're really, they're just way, they're kind of net, excluding all the possible conditions, and they're just kind of overstating how uncertain something is, or is it?
I think it varies widely with the personality and with the topic. There's some topics that lend themselves to succinct statements that you can give to the press, and others that really can't, and you get in trouble if you do. I mean, I think in the climate change field, I think I remember maybe 10 or more years ago, Jim Hansen got in trouble for a little overstating the climate case, and he had to backtrack. And I think it actually hurt things in the long run, but for a while. But so it's a problem. Details, you always want to have details. You work so hard on these measurements, you want to show every last one of them. But the guiding principle should be include only those details when talking to a general public that really reinforce your main points. So pick and choose, and again, you have to think a lot about it beforehand. What are the key points? And then to illustrate those key points, which of your details do the best job? And you're going to leave a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor. So a second principle is give them reasons to care. I mean, you obviously have chosen to pursue a particular topic, and it's really the driving force of your professional life, sometimes entire life. So it's obvious to you why it's important and interesting, but it isn't always obvious to the other person, especially if you're talking to a reporter, and that person in turn has to convey to the public why should they care. And so there's and keep in mind in all of this that you're competing with, in the case of a reporter, other news stories. And it's getting increasingly hard for scientists to put stories about science in newspapers. I think magazines are still pretty good, but you know, there's lots of other stories hitting the press and human interest and people getting shot and world events, Iran sending up rockets. So you're competing. So, and then the other thing is you're giving a general talk. You look at the audience and they're looking at you and you think they're thinking about everything you're saying, but they might be actually thinking about what they're going to have for dinner or you know, what are they going to do about their teenager is giving them so many problems. So it's a challenge. So keep in mind those things when you pick and choose the material you're going to present and how you present it. So here's an example. For climate change, I think it's fairly easy to say why people should care, because I think there's a great interest now in climate change. Clearly it affects us all. It might affect the cute little penguins down in the Antarctic, and that's you know, that's a cheap shot to get people interested in that topic. I put here a view graph I picked from another talk that was a general talk here. The public lectures at KITP are usually pretty good ones, and I think this guy was very effective. So, I mean, he's got a joke at the end. And neutrinos, that's a hard sell. But I think he did a pretty good job convincing you, you know, without the neutrinos, you wouldn't have the sun and the stars or energy, and oh, wow, we'd be in bad shape. And then no news is bad news, so I think it's a very cute thing. Okay, so you've got them motivated. You're going to just give them a few points that you hope that they'll take home with them. But you want to entertain along the way in some way. And when I go to some of these public lectures with my friends who aren't scientists, you know, I find out afterwards some of the things that they really enjoy. They love history. They love it if you put a picture of some scientist from the 1900s or the 1600s and give a little anecdote. That brings it personal to them. Or a personal anecdote about your own career or something that happened. Cartoons always are effective, or humor, some kind of humor, like no news is bad news. Attractive photos. So I have some good and bad examples of some of these things. So here's a talk from a public lecture on the physics of the heart. And it's a little history of this fellow who designed an electrocardiogram. So an electrocardiogram is sort of a technical figure, but it's a familiar one to most people. And then there's a picture of this guy and a little history there. In the recent talk with Raymond Pierre Humbert at the beginning of this program, talked about geoengineering schemes. He told a little, and it was to a public audience that day, he told a little anecdote about the Sword of Damocles, where this young man said, I want to enjoy the life of a king for a day. So the king there in the background says, sure, you can enjoy my food, wine, and women for a day. And but as he was sitting there enjoying these things, he looked over his head and there's a sword. So it's the king says, you know, you don't, there's always this threat, even while I'm enjoying these things. And that's how Pierre Humbert feels about the geoengineering schemes. We might enjoy some warm climate, some more moderate climate for a while, but there might be a breakdown and a bad payoff at the end. I think people like to see pictures of equipment. you know, real world stuff, people talking, and you know, you show them all these schematics, but I think it's good for them to see what this stuff really looks like. And this is, I think, sort of an artistic picture. It's an atomic, a surface at atomic resolution, and I think it's kind of a new world for people. So those are all kinds of things that I think the public picks up on. Okay, so so simplify your visuals. You know, you see, for a typical talk to your colleagues, you might try to put four or five little diagrams on one view graph, so you don't have to keep pressing the return button. But that's not so handy. Here's one that I picked off from a public lecture, and I think it's just too many words. If you put that many words up on a view graph, you're going to be talking to the audience, but they're going to be reading the screen. They're not going to be paying attention to what you say. So if I wanted to introduce this information, I might have separate view graphs, or else just pull in one line at a time. PowerPoint's nice in enabling you to do that. There's just too much information. Or if you're going to make a point, try to use a short little catchphrase. You don't have to put in all the words. A little catchphrase, because you're going to be elaborating on it. Here's one of these examples where there's, first of all, three graphs on one page. This is for a non-technical audience. They don't know what these curves mean. The axes are too small for them to read. And too often, this is what real pet peeve of mine talks to any kind of audience. You put up a view graph, define the axes right away. And so people know exactly what you're plotting against what else. So this is just too technical and too intimidating for a public audience. And this was also one for public. The talk was otherwise a really good talk, but he just threw this up, and you know, why? Why, you know, your audience is gonna be distracted from what you're saying, because they're trying to figure out what are all these numbers, and they can't even read it, and you know, just cut it out. And here's another one that's just a little bit busy that would probably take quite a bit of explaining. This is on the positive example. This is, you recognize the background, it's a talk that I actually really like, this talk. The neutrinos, it's visual. It shows a neutrino is going right through them, and again, a little pun, and writing out a really large number, because that people don't know what would it be, 3, 6, 9, 12. 14, the 10 to the 14 wouldn't mean anything to them, but a lot of zeros gets through there. Okay. And finally, practice your delivery. You tend to speak much faster when you're speaking with a public audience, so you may maybe consciously try to slow yourself down. It's good to time yourself. Typically, the talks go over rather than under, though, even though people are talking faster, because they've just put too much in. So maybe even do a little mental arithmetic. I have 90 slides, and I have 60 minutes, and maybe that's too many slides for the time that I have. That makes sense. So,
also, the slides have the builds. Like one slide can have a lot of stages the way that when you build them, and that's actually multiple slides because you talk about.
That's true.
So it's deceptive just looking at the slide count. You know, you can spend a long time on one slide with all the elements that you put in.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, leave time for questions and for people to ask questions, because that's. You're going to position your talk better if you're responding to the questions and input from the audience. It's best if you can deliver it to some cooperative spouse or other audience. And, you know, the typical pieces of advice apply. You don't want to be pacing the room too much, because that's distracting. You don't want to be standing in the front of your slides. You don't want to have too many hems and haws. But that's why it's good to practice in front of somebody else, because they pick up on things that you're doing. I'm probably doing something really annoying right now that you wish you could tell me to stop. But. Okay, so that's the general part of this talk. Now I wanted to talk more specifically to the climate people, but everybody really, about aspects of, and I'm going to, for now, maybe erase this. Is this the right button? Oh, off?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe this way.
Oh, it's up there. Okay. Okay, so your assignment was to, what are the, you know, in the spirit of simplifying your message and just focusing on some take-home messages, I said, what are the three points that you think would really work well in convincing people about climate change? So I don't know if there's anybody who wants to volunteer.
I have some.
Okay, Christy.
But it depends whether they're from the technology will save us or God will save us.
You mean it depends on the audience?
Yes.
I think that's a really good point. So the argument you use would depend on your assumed audience. Let's start with the technology people first. Let's assume we have a people for whom a rational argument is going to work best. So what would you say to them?
I usually reframe it, because often they're, especially in New York City, they're looking at it from a perspective of the environment is something like a polar bear. It's cute and it's nice and we have to kind of look out for it. But the economy is really what matters. And I try to reframe it as, well, actually, these wetlands and stuff filter the water before it goes back into the ocean. So I try to look at it, describe it as a life support system that we don't know the stability of. And that usually gets them thinking, you know, because often the technology will save us people are people who are very independent of mind, and you can't do all the steps at once. So I usually basically start out by saying, view the climate system not at, or the environment, not as something separate from you, but as something that you're a part of that supports your life function.
Okay. Okay.
That's not really sound bite-y, is it?
So environment is part of you. And vice versa. So where do you go on from there? What do they say? Yeah, well, the environment's fine. I don't see anything wrong. I don't think we're affecting it.
Right, so I stress that it's their life support system, mm-hmm. right? So right now, a lot of us don't even, usually I say right now, we don't really trust even the bottled water anymore. And that's because we sort of are really inefficient, you know? Mm-hmm. And we don't really think about that. And then I ask them, what do you think that later we'll have to bottle the air? And then they often sort of stop for a second, and that's when they start, you know, realizing that, yeah, it's possible that technology could save us, but do we really want to live in that world? And so that's kind of the trajectory for those people often that I send them on.
Okay, so technology could save you from...
Well, no, okay, so the first thing is the life support system.
Right.
And even if, and then I say, well, we don't know the stability of the system. You know, it's only 10 kilometers thick of the atmosphere, and there's, you know, 6.5 billion of us. And then I start going down, we don't know the stability of the system, and we don't know if we have the means to respond to something catastrophic, should it occur. A little fear, a little never. And then the last thing is usually, what did I just say? Do you really want to live in that world where you rely on technology and you can't ever go and sit in a forest and be quiet, you know? So it's kind of a fear-based okay. argument, which isn't really polite. Yeah. For the technology will save us.
In a world.
I tell them go to realclimate.org. Because they always say the same things over and over again. You know, the same, they read the same websites and they see the same sort of And so you can't tell them anything really about the science if they won't, they just won't believe you, because for them it's a belief system. It's not like...
Right, that's why I thought maybe we'll take those people separately. The people who have the same argument that, you know, they've been reading certain websites.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah. Okay, other ideas from other people who have spoken about? Brad?
Well, I find myself often in conversation with people who are obsessing about something else that is not really a concern. Like, they're worried about getting cancer from cell phone tower.
Right, right.
Apple engineer told them that.
Yeah.
Or they're worried about contrails. There's just some crazy idea that contrails, there's a plot to, like, contaminate the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I start by saying that scientists aren't worried about these things, but they are worried about climate change, and that we have changed the composition of the atmosphere. We've increased the carbon dioxide by 35%. That's a really big change.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of try to divert, you know, use some of they're concerned about something. They're concerned about the direction we're going, but they're concerned about crazy things, and I try to bring it around to something that's real. And I would say something like, climate scientists are more worried about climate change than the general public, unlike these other things.
Mm-hmm. And scientists are worried. And do you go further from there then?
Yeah, then if I engage them, then it's to tell them, you know, the greenhouse gases are what keeps the world above freezing. That
yeah.
They're central for maintaining the climate. And so then I close the argument by saying, well, since we're increasing the CO2, then that's bound to have an effect on the climate.
Mm-hmm.
So just keep it very simple, but parlay off of these two ideas that, you know, we should pay attention to the things that we really are altering, and we know that the greenhouse gases are important, and therefore, if we're mucking around them,
it's a problem. Yeah. And how do you find people respond to that?
It gets some of these people who are worrying about all these other things, I think it gets them thinking about what they're paying attention to.
Yeah.
I'm sure one conversation doesn't change.
But then they're probably, hopefully, talking to other scientists at other cocktail parties. Yeah. Other, Paul?
I give public talks on global warming, like Bradley. I start by saying the second point, which is the greenhouse effect and climate feedbacks are what make life possible on Earth, and global warming is a question of too much of a good thing. So I start with the science points, and then I end.
Okay.
And then the second point is about a bit of historical points. The predictions of global warming date from the 19th century, and they really haven't changed. What has changed is the degree of certainty, that there's been more certainty.
Hmm.
And the quality of lines of evidence, the quality of evidence supporting those predictions has improved.
And you emphasize quality over the length of the time series?
Well, I just kind of pulled that into the, you know, it's lines of evidence, so you require, yeah, I mean, if I was going to support that statement, I have to show a few slides. But you can see, yeah, certainly the statistics are improved as you get more observations, but also the observations are reanalyzed as you go back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see all that.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I say is something more, it's more political, but I think it has to be said, which is that you have to recognize trade-offs, right?
Mm-hmm.
That industrialization has brought a lot of benefits, increased longevity, reduced, you know, infant mortality. Richer people are healthier. However, CO2 is a contaminant. You can just think of this as an environmental contamination problem, and you have to decide where the trade-offs lie. And I leave the decision on what to do about it to people I'm talking to. I try not to.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where I sort of, I mean, because, and that's so I leave that to the end of the talk, actually. I usually talk about the scientific evidence first, and then I talk about these, you know. I mean, the reality is we all, everybody mm-hmm. in America is living a highly energy-intensive life. That's the, why do we like it, and what are the trade-offs? What are the side effects?
So, mm-hmm.
And that I think it's important to recognize the benefits of the life we live now, as
right.
well as the harm,
yes, yes.
because people's perception is that that they react to is saying that everybody's doing everything wrong now, and it might be true. However, a lot of people are striving for the same lifestyle we have, so we have to talk about why that is.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to be very honest about that, and. I do point into Real Climate, but Real Climate is a very political website, and if you're dealing with conservative people, it mm-hmm. might not, you know, it can just as easily backfire. You know,
yeah.
to say, oh, that's just liberal, blah, blah, mm-hmm. whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to be, so I say Spencer Wirt's website on Discovery Global Warming,
mm-hmm.
that's a really great science website.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And maybe more accessible. I think there's a lot of Real Climate that depends on a very, I mean, I think it's something that I like to read as background, but I think.
Yeah, let me be clear. I think Real Climate is an excellent website.
And mm-hmm.
a really big service. Mm-hmm. However, it's not necessarily for everybody,
yeah.
especially for people who
yeah.
aren't persuaded.
For those people who are not in the climate change program, how many are familiar with Real Climate as a website? Okay, but if you're not, it's just realclimate.org. And they debunk a lot of, many of the, they debunk a lot of many of the issues that arise, especially from some of the climate change skeptics. I mean, they give credit for some things that are real concerns, but they also say where there's a division between what is something that is a real concern and something that is not.
And what's the other site, Spencer Words?
It's on the AIP website, and it's...
So that would be
just Google Discovery of Global Warming. Yeah. The website and then a book he's written, which is there's a new edition coming out.
And Word is spelled is Spencer. Actually, I don't know if it's an S-E-R. Other thoughts about, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I guess my experience thinking about global warming is mostly to do with teaching undergrads and so usually I start by just stating the fact that climate is changing right now and that we see climate change every day. And so by this, and you can go over the evidence of basically past centuries changing the landscape, changing the cloud cover, snow cover, and temperature itself. The second point is really that so most scientists think that climate change is going to continue over the next century.
Do the students notice that it's changing, or they've read about and things like that?
Yeah, they mostly read about. I mean, and they have anecdotal evidence, but that's usually not. It's usually not very solid, but they've read about it.
Mm-hmm. So you say, so scientists say it will continue for a century.
Yeah. And then usually, I didn't say, well, there is some things, I mean, we can do something about it, but it's not going to be easy.
Mm-hmm.
There are some practical things that can be done right now and should be done, but there is no easy solution to the problem either.
What are some of the things you stress that you think could be done?
I mean, mostly it has to do with energy efficiency and so on, and then on the long run to find alternative energy sources.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how many find that in talking to the public, people are asking, what can we do? Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I give that talk, and then they're asking, I call it the fourth point.
Why?
Because they sort of leave it to that, you decide, and they say, okay, we believe it, so what do we do? And I'm energy efficiency, but it really, to have a very good answer to that, you really have to, I mean, it requires a,
yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a very hard question. I think most people I think they have a sense that they want to do things, and they've, and I hear them talking about being proud about things they're doing, like hanging out their laundry and not using the dryer, and that's good. But I don't think they have a sense of the big terms, but I'm not sure I do either. But I think it might be useful to have some compilation of on an individual level, what are the things you could do, and what is, how could you rank order the effectiveness of those?
People have a very poor sense of scale when it comes to energy. So I was told we should put solar cells on the wings of planes so that we can count, you know, the amount of energy these planes use. Yeah. They just have no idea of orders and magnitude. So if you could talk in this last part, which I also did talk about, if you could get some sense of the magnitudes of the things we're talking about, that could be very persuasive, and it really shows how huge the problem is. So the fact that a car puts out an enormous amount of power compared to, say, the electricity that your home consumes. You know? So people need to know that, because otherwise they think that it's kind of easy to fix these problems.
But aside from things that are directly related to energy consumption, most people have no idea the amount of energy that goes into manufacturing and being food, or any consumer good.
There's lots of, not lots, but several popular books, you know, 50 Things You Can Do, you know, those kind of books, but they don't give any sense of, you know, which are significant and which aren't, and it seems to be really easy to just reorganize them with that information.
Right, right. Does anyone know of a website where that kind of thing is done? I mean, I'm sure we could all know where to find the information and compile the table, but I think it might be very useful.
I think Al Gore's website, we might have it. I'm not sure. But
yeah.
There are some websites that let you compute your carbon footprint, which is also very, your carbon, so you can enter, so what's your fuel bill, I mean your electricity bill.
Yes.
These are direct consumption estimates. Energy tracks not income, period. And in this country, it's double what normal countries should have. And that's it. You want to reduce energy consumption, you reduce consumption, and, you know, period. It's related to everything. It's a lot of, you know, really it's crazy just to say to people, walk instead of this, but continue to use the same consumer goods. Live the same life, but just walk instead of taking a car. It's really false.
Or sometimes I get, sometimes you see these catalogs of ecological products, but the fact that it's a product means it's already not ecological. I mean, you'd be better off not ordering anything, but yes.
There are websites that do life cycle analysis, which are which account for like the transportation of the good, the
manufacturing. Of the appliance or the whatever good it is.
Yeah, appliance, cars, clothing, anything I think you can like basically put a price to that's sold on market and is commonly found. But usually those websites are pretty technical, so they're for like people who actually do research that's not that accessible, but you can, if you know like where to look, you can put stuff in and then find out, oh, how much energy is used, how much carbon is emitted for one of these products.
Yeah.
Steve Koonin's slides for this energy talking is are very good for giving you a perspective on the energy flow in the world. I mean, it's, you know, it's for a technical audience, but those are things that we absorb and bring to other people.
I tell people to garden because the life cycle and the and then just walk them through the steps of.
Are they going to use fertilizer in that garden?
because the people don't really think about the whole supply chain of how much energy is in that can of beans on the shelf versus how much energy it took to pick it and can it and put the label on the can and the ink in the label and the, and when they start thinking like that, then they get overwhelmed. And but if you just grow your own tomatoes, you cut that or go to the farmer's market. I mean, presuming they don't drive too far with your vegetables to get. It cuts out us, if you do that every week and that's your primary source, it cuts out a lot of.
One argument that often brings up, but not all the time, is the fact that the single, I mean, especially when you talk to undergrad students, the single biggest decision that they can make in terms of the impact on greenhouse gases is basically how many kids they want to have. It's a very heavy argument, and I don't always bring it up, but I think it's a point that needs to be made once in a while. And it kind of put things in perspective too.
Yeah.
But,
Europe has learned that, right? This country's learned it too, except for immigration, which also has low population growth. So that lesson's been learned.
Yeah.
You're teaching the converted.
Yeah. But especially in our
country. But the motivation is different.
Yes. The motivation is the same. Yeah.
To increase your economic well-being.
Well, there's a reverse argument in some of the poorer countries. They need the people to help work. And
per capita.
Yeah, and the per capita energy assumptions.
Yeah, so I guess you could say the best thing is to get a low-paying job.
Before we get too far afield from original topic, I wanted to put on, before Raymond Pierre Humbert left, I had him give me his list of three topics. So there's a convergence of some of these, which we're not surprised. So I guess it'll come on. So he said, first of all, the increase of carbon dioxide is due to humans. So, and you can show real data on that. And basic physics says that the CO2 will increase the greenhouse warming. So that's the same thing that a number of you have said. Raymond said he really stresses that it's not a computer program, that there's some real basic physics concepts behind this, because some people are so distrustful of computers. And then he talks about feedbacks, and that's one thing that hadn't been mentioned here. He said there are feedbacks in the system that amplify the warming, and he mentioned several that we know about, the sea ice and the water vapor feedback. When he talks about clouds, he said, yeah, they could make the warming a little less, but they could also make it much worse. And the amount by which it makes it much less is much smaller than the amount by which it can be make it much worse is much bigger. So he tries to make the analogy to it's like investors. If you have some money to invest, and there's a small chance that that it would lose money, but there's a real high chance that it would make a lot of money if you make that investment. So those are the three arguments that Raymond would put up. But then after he said that, he said, the arguments that persuade scientists are not necessarily the ones that convince others. And so his examples were the polar bear and Katrina and the Antarctic glaciers. Katrina is something I think has scared a lot of people. And yet, as scientists, I don't think we can say, yeah, we wouldn't have had Katrina if it hadn't been for global warming. I mean, it would be politically make it easier to sell the case, but you can't do that. But that's something that people have reacted to, and I think it makes them want to believe a little bit more in the climate change.
But, I mean, in a way, even though we cannot say Katrina is due to global warming, I think something like Katrina is a very good example that even though we're a modern society and we have all this technology, we're still very susceptible to environmental disaster, that all the 20th century technology doesn't protect us from weather, nasty weather events and things like that.
Right.
So I think even without making the point that Katrina is due to global warming, which I don't think anyone can make, you can use Katrina as to point that
I guess you could make the point that if you perturb the climate system, which we sure we're doing, you will have unpredicted and out of the ordinary events like this. You don't know what they are or when they would be. But, Also, I think that stresses, I think so many of the people make the argument, I can't believe in global change because it's too expensive. It's going to cost money. We can't afford to fight it, so it must not be true. So, where did I have? So, these are some of the common criticisms that I are harder. I think are harder to deal with. So, the first two are the hockey stick is wrong. You know, you have people who know no science and do very little reading of science, and then they come up and say, "Oh, yeah, but it was much warmer, like 200 years ago, you know, in the Middle Ages than it is now. And so why should we be worried about this?" And they know a lot about that one particular argument, and I think it's because they read it on a website. And they don't know about the wealth of the other arguments. Or it's a natural variation is another thing that they tend to read on certain conservative websites. Or it's due to the sun. I didn't put up here, it's cost more, but I think that a lot of people are concerned about it. I think that motivates a lot of people to be skeptical about climate change. And then I also get this one, we shouldn't cut our greenhouse gases until China does. So it's like, yeah, oh yeah, but they haven't done it, so why should we? So this takes us into that other regime of how do you deal with the people who are either coming from a conservative bias and inclined not to believe it at all, or, well, how do you respond to some of these things?
Well, the last one, you could say our per capita emissions are way above those of China.
Yeah.
So, the argument, then they say, well, it doesn't matter what we do because they're going to do it. They're going to overload the system, which is probably wrong. Mm-hmm.
I think of it as two people. Yeah. 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 I sort of picture two people sitting in a rowboat that's leaking. And it's like saying, I'm not going to bail until he does. And meanwhile, they're both sinking. It's just, I don't know whether they'd make it a little cartoon. I like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And actually, in many ways, China is more convincing. Obviously, the problem is China. Yeah. Yeah. So
China?
I mean, there is, at least for China part, there is a bit of information that the gas mileage of Chinese car is better than the U.S. gas mileage, which, to show, I mean, I think it goes in the same way, that the idea that the Chinese do not care about global warming, so we shouldn't care. I think it's not especially true. But at the end, the last is more a political argument than an ethical argument.
Yes, it is.
And you can argue on a scientific basis.
Right, and then it takes a scientist into a realm where he doesn't have any particular advantage over anyone else, or special knowledge, I should say. Yeah.
Al Gore's movie. The last issue he doesn't present as an economic or political issue, but a moral one.
And I suppose the point is that if you know something is wrong, it's wrong. And if you know something is right, it's right, and whether or not it hurts you more than someone else. I think he's trying to sell it as a moral issue because it doesn't matter what other people choose to do. If you think it's wrong, you should do something about
it. Yes?
I find like there's no really reasonable, I don't know, the cost of mitigating climate change.
Yes.
There's not that much of reasonable evidence that backs up that it's going to do a lot of damage to our economy. And on the contrary, like developing alternative energies is actually, I think, one of the recent fads and like hedge fund investment and stuff like that. So I would say if we know how to deal with it the right way, or if we plan it early enough, it's going to actually be a good thing for the county. And that's what I would tell people who are concerned about, you know, the costs of trying to make a complaint.
Well, there's a, I mean, there's some history about that. I don't have the curves, but there's, you know, if you, I think energy efficiency has done a lot for our economy. So, you know, if you look at curves of our energy, I think it's energy per unit, per gross domestic product is actually going down. And in the 1970s, when there was this energy crisis, there were all these predictions at the time that, you know, here is the time versus energy. And people saying, oh, yeah, we're gonna, you know, this would be business as usual, or we might increase because the economy has to grow. And Amory Lovins was the wild-eyed liberal, and he was saying, no, I think we could do this. And people were laughing at him. This is
per production.
And the total energy use in the country versus time. And people, this was like the early 70s. And these were these projections. And people said, well, it's going to increase or at least do business as usual because you can't decouple energy use from gross domestic product. They go hand in hand. But in fact, we did decouple them, and the actual curve was closer to what this Amory Lovins was, and then since then it's inched up. But
this is per GDP dollar, right? Like that's because the total energy use has gone up a lot,
I think in the 1970s it pretty much stayed flat for a while, and then it inched up a bit, but it definitely didn't go up like this. I think if it were energy per gross domestic product, it would be flat. It would have been flat at that time because it had been fairly flat. People sort of believed that they couldn't be decoupled. So I think you're right that your point was well taken, that there's lots of data you can, I've probably done a lousy job of bringing it in, but there's lots of data to support the effectiveness of energy efficiency, at least. Yes?
A lot of people don't have a good concept of, you know, when these models say, oh, the temperature is going to increase by 1 degree, 2 degrees, 5 degrees, whatever
mm-hmm.
it is,
mm-hmm.
they don't have a, that doesn't seem like a lot. That seems like, okay, so it's 75 outside, so in a year it'll be 76, who cares, right? Mm-hmm. But I think if you can put it into a context of just our own, sort of our own body temperature, I mean, you know, 98.6 degrees, that's your normal body temperature, and you feel awful just a degree or two above that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you can die, you know, you'll be dead if you've got, you know, 106 degree temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like this, it's a very small range of sort of what our own, you know, human body is capable of. Our body is capable of, you know, withstanding a lot, but just our own body temperature and what that feels like. So it's almost like a thermometer for the planet.
Yeah.
Are there the small temperature changes.
Mm-hmm.
If you can put that in the context of,
mm-hmm.
well, what would that mean just for you if your body
yeah.
temperature
yeah.
went up a degree?
Could I have the climate change people react to that? You know, how do you explain, or what do you say when people say, well, 1 degree C isn't going to be a big deal?
Usually at that point, I think bringing the case so that we're talking about mean temperature and then the comparison with the last ice age where global temperature was maybe 5 degrees colder than now, and yet we had 3,000 meters of ice over Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of saying that. The number might be small, but the impact is actually quite significant.
Mm-hmm.
Like just
comparable variation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Saying that also that the expected increase in temperatures in the mid latitudes is going to be greater than that. That's a global mean,
mm-hmm.
and so it's going to be greater the further you go away from the equator.
Right.
And then you start talking about some of the likely consequences like sea level rise. And perhaps the spread of tropical diseases further northward and so on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Especially, I think you were talking about sensitivity to the human body. I think there's a lot of sensitivity to, we see it in fish. I think in the El Nino years, you see a migration of the kinds of fish because they're very sensitive to temperatures in the ocean. So there's variations in the impact of that average number, but it's greater, much greater in some parts of the world than in others, and over some times of the year. I also saw a talk once where if you have an increase of 1 degree C for the year, it gives you a much larger increase in the number of degree days above a certain temperature. And so, and those are the extreme weathers, either below or above, or when you get, you know, people, so marginal people suffering, like older people falling on ice or suffering heat stroke and things like that.
Yeah. Also some pretty mm-hmm. impressive pictures about the cumulative effect at retreats of glaciers that have been exhibited for relatively small changes in global temperatures. And
right.
There are pictures that have been taken over tens of years.
Right, right.
There is also, in terms of past climate, so the last interglacial, which ended about 100,000 years ago, was about 1 or 2 degrees warmer than now, and then at least pre-industrial temperature. Mm-hmm. And we know from then that the sea level were about 5 to 10 meters higher than now, and most of Greenland was ice-free. It's one point that actually something that we know from past climate that we can say 1 or 2 degrees warmer, it's not, I mean, it's significant
in your context to present. But rather than putting that in the context of Greenland, which, you know, 99.999% of the people you meet have never been to, who never will go to, I mean, putting it into the context of something that they're actually familiar with, like New Orleans or New York or...
Florida's underwater.
Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
Somewhere they might be planning to vacation.
Right.
The disappearance of Glacier National Park. Of the glaciers.
What about weather patterns? Those of you who studied looking at weather patterns, is there some evidence for the sensitivity of some of those patterns to change in the global mean?
More extreme events.
Or precipitation. There's pretty solid evidence there of the actual changes in mid-latitude storms and intensities. There's predictions, but actually predictions aren't very robust. So I focus more actually on the degree days. I mean, heat waves and warmer nights fewer cold extreme days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those kind of thermal impacts. I think I like to focus on those. And then the changes to precipitation.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think you can talk to people who are of any interest in agriculture at all. It doesn't have to be a really technically involved audience, but mm-hmm. anybody who thinks about that at all, you know, and is worried about food prices. I mean, you show them Australia, you show them the predicted changes from the climate models on precipitation and the observations for the last century, and they line up pretty well. Now.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, well, look, you know, this is going as predicted, and the consequences are such and such.
Right.
So for droughts, I mean, so that stuff. So at some point I think sometimes you can be a little more technical because people do think about droughts and, you know, mm-hmm. that's a reality that's in the news a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can appeal to that. But I agree with your basic point that it's mm-hmm. good to relate to something you can feel.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's also the evidence that in the Northwest, the forests there have suffered a beetle invasion because the nights in the winter, the winters are no longer cold enough to kill off those beetles, and then the beetles are eating the trees, and that's giving rise to more forest fires because the trees are now dead and more prone to fires. So again, maybe that doesn't convince people living in California, which is far south of those areas, but it's not too far from home. Yes?
I think it's also important in every interaction with the general public to try to actually educate them as opposed to giving them a soundbite, because the next person they talk to may be on the other side, the two soundbites cancel out, and the person goes away saying, oh, those people don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the opportunity to actually try to educate them, some small point, something they can understand,
mm-hmm.
take away and be more knowledgeable,
mm-hmm.
then the next time they find somebody on the other other side, mm-hmm. they'll have at least one piece of information that sticks with them.
Yeah. Do you think some of these points are that kind of information, the kind of education that you're thinking about?
Very difficult. It's such a complicated problem. Yeah. It's really easy to get up and give sound bites.
Well, these are summaries of talks that we've given. I mean, the actual talks themselves, you spend about, maybe 10 to 15 minutes on each point.
Sure.
Beyond that, they have to start reading.
But this thing that it's not a natural variation, mm-hmm. that gets you into trouble right away, because we, in fact, don't know what's possible with natural variations. As you go back in time, the time resolution gets worse and worse. And for us to be able to say 10 million years ago there was not a climate change of much larger magnitude in rate than there is today gets to be really, really difficult.
I don't think that's the argument that people are making and going that far back in time.
People say, oh, this is just a natural variation.
Well, no, I hear that argument, but I'm saying I don't know that the scientists counter it by saying that we understand all the variations. I think we don't. But how do you scientists counter the argument of it's a natural variation? How do you to talk to people who say, well, we don't know that it's what we're seeing isn't just a natural process?
Well, one thing I know is that people have a very poor understanding of time, deep time. Mm-hmm. So they think, oh, there were these ice ages, and so the climate varied wildly, and so it could be just doing that now. Mm-hmm. And so I try to make them aware of what a vast stretch of time that was, and how climate's been relatively stable for the past 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So then I then emphasize how much it's changing right now.
Yeah.
So that sort of gets kind of hockey stick argument.
Yeah.
That word "it's" isn't terribly precise, and there are two things that change. One is the climate, and one is what the atmosphere is made of. And the fact that atmospheric composition is changing because of people, I think, is indisputable. We know what that variation has been over time. Mm-hmm. The response to that change, it is harder to establish as opposed to climate variation. So at least the first one, the CO2 variation, mm-hmm. is easier to explain how we know and how we measure it. And then understanding the physics of how the greenhouse effect works is also easy to communicate and mm-hmm. easy to understand. Mm-hmm. That would be a good thing for everyone to understand. Everyone should know how it works, because the button is what makes Earth habitable in the first place.
Right, right. It's pretty easy to show a simple diagram of the radiation balance and say, the energy in is energy out. So.
Yeah, I think the important point there is absolutely right. There are some things we know virtually 100% certainly.
Mm-hmm.
CO2 is increasing, I think there's no question. And you go all the way to the other end and say that this is an unnatural variation that we've never seen before and it's caused by us. Okay, well, that gets a tad iffy. When it gets presented to the general public, it's always black or white, that everything is known to the same degree of uncertainty, which is kind of fuzzy. And if we can convince them of some things are dead set, other things are still under discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And let them know that scientists face this problem all the time and that we don't always know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, to go back, I mean, and I think it's sort of the issue of the natural variation. And so, I mean, we can point out the CO2, but whether what's causing the temperature fluctuation in the 20th century, it's true, it's a very difficult one. But there is quite a bit of work that has been done on the issue, and a lot of that is in the IPCC and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's somewhat technical, because it's comparing different models with and without forcing and things like that. But there is very strong evidence to say that it is human caused and not the natural variation. I mean, the natural variation cannot really explain the temperature in the 20th century. So I feel comfortable talking about it, but it's true that there is no simple. I don't know any simple way of making the argument.
Right. And I know IPCC has this figure that they show the temperature variation in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
And what that temperature variation would be if you didn't have the increased CO2, but you did have the El Nino and some of the volcanoes, and the only thing that reproduces it, the actual observations, is the CO2 with the greenhouse gases. But then that asks people to believe in the climate models. So there is that degree of uncertainty.
Well, that has to be an important part of the discussion. You can't avoid talking about the models.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to talk about what the physical principles are and other branches of sciences that go biological or chemistry, the chemical parts of those models, and talk about how they're tested and built. So in a longer talk, you have time to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, I mean, that's where you have to sit. I mean, as a modeler, I spend time persuading people that, you know, I think that we understand the limitations of these models, their strengths and weaknesses, and that they could present a consistent picture.
Mm-hmm.
But you have, I mean, I just think you there's no escaping that. It's a hard part to talk about. You shouldn't sell it. You should talk about them honestly. But I think they're, you know, I think they do tell us they're an important tool. So
yeah.
Not right away. Because if you start with that, then people just...
Okay. So the strong part is to start with the observations.
Yeah, basic physics.
I mean, the basic physics of why the radiation balance, why it warms the Earth, and the observation that the greenhouse gases are increasing. Those are kind of really solid things. Yeah. And then go on from there.
I think that's why Ray's third point was on the cloud feedback, because that allowed him to talk about some of these uncertainties.
Mm-hmm.
So we can have this discussion that, yes, the models make this prediction, mm-hmm. but there's some uncertainty there.
Right.
And
it could be worse.
The way he sketched it, he shows, you know, this is on the worst side, and here's the minus sign, and here's like this, what the cloud feedbacks might do for you. You know, they might make it better, but there's a much more greater chance that make it worse. Yeah. So, have we beat this horse to death? keep. Yeah, I think it's so important to keep talking about it, and hopefully, exchanging ideas about how you talk about it is helpful.
Is the problem to convince people that there is a problem, or is it that we don't have very...
Well, the problem is to get there. I mean, translate it into, what to do.
What to do.
The exiled by high gas taxes, but what to do,
mm-hmm.
one thing to do would be to double the price of gasoline. $8 a gallon.
Motivated.
It costs in Europe,
yeah.
Which is as double the efficiency that
we have. Yeah. Well, then we're getting into an argument. What's the best way to motivate energy and change in behavior? Is it a high price?
There's a proposal in Canada for a national carbon tax, and it excludes gasoline.
It excludes gasoline?
That fact, like that just completely undermines people, you know, the direct impact on the consumer.
Prime Minister of Canada is from Alberta.
Yeah, no, but he's not it's the opposition party that came up with it.
Yeah.
But the thing is that's regarded as regressive taxation, taxing gasoline because everybody uses it. But still, it's really something. I mean, people have to, that's what you have to do. When you get into it, you have to really talk about really difficult decisions.
Art Rosenfeld has all these interesting schemes. He's one of our energy commissioners. He has all these really interesting schemes for motivating energy efficiency. And he had one scheme where you put a heavy sales tax on an expensive car that used a lot of gas and gave a tax credit to the purchase of the inexpensive, and you set the dividing line between them so that the whole thing is neutral. Revenue neutral, so that the people driving the gas guzzlers are paying for the energy efficient cars. So I mean, there's room for a very clever. But I think I really would like to see something like a chart with prioritize, well, just that outline the measures that an individual could take and what the carbon gain would be or carbon savings would be. There's a whole other set that an individual doesn't have much control over, but society should be aware of. You know, like an individual can't choose how efficient the power plant is, but there's choices to be made there. Yeah.
If the solution is to cut consumption in an absolute sense, I mean, am I ready to sell my house and move into a small apartment? How many of you are? I mean,
mm-hmm. I'll train with you.
Just don't. I mean, the prescriptions are always, you know, for somebody else to do something.
Yeah.
Is the point.
Yeah. No, it's
and
very hard.
We're all going to have to. If it's not going to be an easy sell if the only solution is cut your consumption.
Right.
One of the major questions you raised is how to deal with the skeptics as to whether the temperature rises are anthropogenic or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a public lecture from, I guess it was Nate Lewis from Caltech, and he raised the following point of view. Without taking a position on that, he said the consequences are so severe, are you willing to take the risk of doing nothing to try to mitigate it?
Yeah, yeah. That so many people have commented so positively about that public lecture. And if anyone has a chance to hear Nate Lewis talk about energy, you should do so, because it's a very good and stimulating talk. Or you can see it on the KITP website, right?
Yeah, or on his website.
Okay. Okay, well, keep talking about it.
Thank you.
Very much.